brief, and then at the end, addressing my own issues, which was computation of damages. As I stated, that essentially this appeal has to do with invited error. As you know, there was an issue with the answer that was not filed in a timely manner, and in fact, upon review of the record, there was an administrative error through e-filing that the answer, in fact, was not filed. Essentially, where that brought us to is we proceeded on a trial on the merits and with the plaintiff or appellant being the prevailing party. In discussing the invited error that was caused, I'd like to address NRCP Rule 15B, which basically what we had here is we had a complete trial on the merits. There were no motions for summary judgment filed during the course of the, I believe it's a three-year course of litigation. On the motion to dismiss that was filed, and I'll go into detail about that, the motion to dismiss was essentially filed for failure to join a party and issues of claim preclusion. Again, despite the fact that that motion was denied, we proceeded on the merits of the case. I'd like to refer the court to the state case of LaChance versus State, which Justice Cherry wrote the opinion, along with Hardesty and Paraguay. And essentially, what that case involves is that an appellant cannot take advantage of an error that was invited or caused by them and present that evidence on appeal. There's a few other cases that Justice Cherry happened to be involved, which also include invited error that was, and that is Karstefan v. Mosner, where I believe it was Justice Pickering that drafted the dissent on that case, also involving invited error. And when we deal with how invited error affects this appeal, the first issue that we have to deal with, like I said, is NRCP 15B, which essentially allows the court to hear an issue, an appellate court, to hear an issue that was not raised in the pleadings when the issue was tried with express or implied consent of the parties. Now, because we have the history of this case, which included a motion to dismiss and a failure to file objections to any evidentiary issues, the parties submitted joint exhibits. There were no objections under NRCP 16A to any of the exhibits that were filed. What we have here is a complete acquiescence to try this case on the merits. Now, again, 15B, when issues are not raised by the pleadings and are tried by express or implied consent of the parties, they shall be treated as in all respects that they have been raised in the pleadings. And again, I'd like to take the court through a litany of actions by the respondents that even gives more weight to why the cross appeal is based on invited error. The first thing is defendants failed to file an MSJ, motion for summary judgment, is implied consent that the matter is to be tried on merits. The defendant's failure to object to testimony regarding the liquor license precludes him from claiming a waiver of affirmative defense, and I'm sorry I'm calling him the defendant, I know it's the respondent cross appellant. Again, failure to object during the trial generally precludes appellant precludes appellate consideration of the issue, and that again is LaChance versus State, which also brings us to the respondents' discussions of NRCP 8, which regarding the affirmative defenses that were never presented in trial or prior to trial. NRCP 8 essentially says that if affirmance are not admitted, if they are not denied in a responsive pleading. Here we have an administrative error where there was absolutely no responsive pleading filed. Okay, so...
That is the reply to counterclaim?
Correct, correct.
I was just curious, though, if the reply to counterclaim wasn't filed, wouldn't you have to file a 55B notice of default before...
Correct.
Did that ever happen?
No, there was no 55B, and I was going to go into that.
Okay, sorry.
There was no, again, NRCP 55B motion ever filed. Essentially what happened, and I'm sure you've reviewed the transcript, we had filed an answer to the counterclaim, I believe it was 2 days before the trial. What happened was through the e-filing system, it got kicked back because there was a PDF error during the filing. At that point, we proceeded to trial on the merits with a prevailing party. There was no Rule 15 motion presented by the respondents at that time, so we just submitted on the trial on the merits of the case. So again, as you mentioned, there was no NRCP 55 motion made throughout the course of the litigation or at the time of trial, which is essentially we would be entitled to 3 days' notice under 55. Again, there were no objections to any evidence submitted under NRCP 16A3, which waived any evidentiary arguments on the evidence presented at trial, other than that it waived anything with authentication and so on and so forth. Once the motion to dismiss was denied by Judge Alf, the respondents had an opportunity to file a writ of mandamus or a writ of prohibition, and they didn't do so, which waives any argument at that point regarding the motion to dismiss for the two causes of action, which were joinder of necessary party under NRCP 19, and there was an issue as to res judicata and claim preclusion as well. And those two issues were in fact brought under the motion to dismiss. Again, once we started trial, as it is demonstrated in the transcript, we presented the answer. We had, for all purposes, assumed that that answer had been filed and it hadn't been kicked back. We only found out that it was kicked back after the trial. Again, no motions for a mistrial to preserve the record for any type of prejudicial effect of filing an answer, not necessarily that Judge Alf ruled in a prejudicial effect, but at least where the respondent or defendant at the time would have had an issue or believed there was prejudicial effect. I believe that there was an opportunity to buffer a mistrial right at the commencement of the trial, and there was none done.
Let me, this time's getting away real quickly. Going back to if they were to have necessary parties, real quickly, do you want to legally comment on that? And also, the calculation of damages, why it's, both sides seem to be still not happy about that issue, comment on those two things.
Sure. Our calculation of damages, I believe the respondents are requesting a standard of review of de novo because it is under contract. We are requesting, we're fine obviously with de novo, but essentially what we requested was clear error because of the fact that the computation damages is based on a monthly lease. And I hope I'm answering your question. If you're referring to the liquor license, I could get to that.
However the damages came up and however you see them, just tell us what
okay.
You think. Okay. Again, I think that main issue, the procedural issue is interesting because it's unusual
right.
In this case, but I think the guts of this case are the damage calculations. What does the contract mean when it refers to liquor license? Is it temporary? Is it permanent?
Okay.
Is it tavern? Is it other types? You know, that's the part, the legal issue we're trying to explore.
Okay. So computation of damages, we're at $860. The computation of damages is essentially the term of the lease that has remained prior to the mitigation of damages when the spot was relet. So that is how we arrived at 101,000.
And the judge limited it to what, 41?
She limited it to 41.
The time period while they had the temporary liquor license.
Correct. Now, one of our arguments, both in our pretrial brief and in front of you, is that, first and foremost, the respondent breached his lease and he was evicted from the lease. So a failure to comply with the terms of the lease precludes him from claiming that he never got a liquor license because, first of all, during trial, we found out that he actually never applied for a liquor license. It was his partner or the individual that he invested in the restaurant.
Well, that's part of my concern with dispensable and indispensable parties, because you have two individual guarantees, you have a partnership or corporation that actually signed this agreement, and you're going only against one party. So
okay,
that's kind of a concern as to the basic issues.
Okay, and I'd like to address that by going back for a minute to the motion to dismiss.
Let me caution you. You have 325 remaining. That's public, including rebuttal time at this point. So if you have points to make them very quickly so you save yourself some time to rebuttal.
Okay, then I think I have everything covered. Two more points. Again, that what I'd like to mention is that I would like this court to use the discretionary standard of the manifest weight of the evidence, which essentially that this court will not reverse a judgment as against the weight of the evidence of any believable evidence that supports the district court. And with that, I will reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Your Honors, good afternoon. May it please the court. My time is limited, so I'm going to speak as quickly as I can. Let's talk about the calculation of damages. Just want to jump to there for a second. The judge entered a judgment and had counsel for Eldon do the calculation of damages. We complained about that, saying, how did you come up with $41,000? It was not even explained in the briefing to this court. The exhibits of trial show that they paid $20,000 initial money. The judge found it was from December to May. You've got $4,000.
It was from Peyton Rand or Less Security Department.
Correct. The judge found the breach from that, December through May 31st period. Rent's $4,000 a month, CAMs are $1,400. You've gotten $20,000 up front, which it says $8,000 for security. It also says $8,000 for last month's rent. How was the calculation done at $41,000? Don't know. Your Honor, what the two interesting issues in this case really are is the switching of adversaries under the Parkland case. Plaintiff Eldon found out, John Gordana, my client. I'm Joseph Mullen on behalf of John Gordana, defendant. Mr. Gordana, John, found out through a fax that there was a first case. We filed a motion to dismiss. Under the Park Lane case of defensive collateral estoppel, there's three elements. Number one, are you the same parties? Well, the plaintiff is absolutely the same parties. Number two, is the issue the same? The complaints were cut and pasted. The third element is, was there an adjudication on the merits? Well, as this court is aware, under NRCP 41B, a dismissal for failure to prosecute is on the merits. That is the issue we put forward to the district court in 2012. Now, there was an argument to this court that...
Was it dismissed with prejudice? That specifically say with prejudice on
the merits? The arbitrator's recommendation, Your Honor, and that was attached to my motion to dismiss. The arbitrator's recommendation said that it should be dismissed with prejudice.
Excuse me.
Just very quickly on that, wasn't there some issue as to that ever being finalized or ruled on by the district court?
Yes, Your Honor. That was Exhibit B to my motion to dismiss. Exhibit C on that motion to dismiss was the notice to prevailing party that the arbitrary award can now be entered, however you want to phrase it. I don't have the exact terminology. It was a notice to one of the defendants to supply the document to court. He was an improper person. That was never done. What I pointed out to the district court though was, I've searched. How do you get rid of an arbitration award more than 30 days outside of the trial denial period? At that point, the arguments made by Eldon to the district court were limited to, it's a bankruptcy issue, or you acquiesce to it. My opposition properly addressed those regarding we acquiesce to it, we agreed to it, we went along with it. There was no evidence submitted, there was no affidavit submitted in that. And regarding the ability of the to set it aside, I apologize, Your Honor, I'm really nervous. I wanted to get all of this out. The arbitrator noted that no action was taken in that case. That was the Exhibit B. We'll pull back for a second. And that no answer having been filed by two of the defendants, he then said to the remaining defendant, who was Anthony Haddad, said, you can come forward now, and you, and the arbitrator specifically said, the award is hereby entered in favor of Anthony Haddad, a.k.a. Robert Anthony Haddad, and against plaintiff LLC, and the matter should be dismissed with prejudice. Eshai is bearing on fees and costs. Exhibit C was the notice to prevailing party that a final judgment may now be entered. John's motion delineated the legal argument that pursuant to NRCP 41B, a dismissal for failure to prosecute is on the merits. We invited at that point Elton to come forward and show how this is not a final judgment. They stated, well, one party was in bankruptcy. As this court is aware, that does not stay in the actions of the other parties. Secondly, we showed to the district court in a reply to opposition that that bankruptcy was dismissed on May 19, 2011, well before the first case was even dealt with arbitration. The second big issue here, Your Honors, don't want to run out of time, is the failure to file the answer and counterclaim to the counterclaim as well as affirmative defenses. Now, I made an oral motion when this trial started to strike what I believe had been filed at that point because I had received it by fax.
Counsel, as Justice Gibbons pointed out, there's other statutory requirements that you actually make a filing. It's not trial by ambush. You don't wait for the last day to do that. It clearly wasn't timely done. That may not be a problem, but the other, in terms of this overlapping bankruptcy and this problem with Mr. Haddad, because both parties were part of the LLC, so it's like trying to get a grip on this wonderful little situation we have, not to mention one of the terms about in the contract as the liquor license, the appropriateness, because you're talking about a full service bar, 1,500 feet from whatever. Normally it's a restaurant license or a service bar type license situation, so that's confusing itself. But looking at what's in front of the court in terms of real parties, whether or not we have indispensable parties, not part of it, but more important, the calculation of damages based on what we have, to really cut down to the chase, why shouldn't this court just remand this back to the district court?
As far as the calculation of damages, Your Honor, before I go to this one second, regarding the NRCP 55B notice of default, I'm going there. The only thing I say is we didn't ask for default. We asked to have the affirmative defenses, not allowed, and the facts that we put forward in evidence. That's the only thing I'm going to say about that, Your Honor.
Normally you bring that before the court if you're going to do that. You notice an opportunity to respond. That's the way it's normally done here.
I did that in 727, brief, Your Honor. Okay. But back to the calculation of damages. A condition precedent to the enforcement of this contract was obtaining a full liquor license.
Does it say full liquor license?
No, it does not.
Just says liquor license.
Liquor license.
So how do we know if it's temporary, full, tavern, it's ambiguous, that term, so how do we, as an appellate court, deal with that?
As far as ambiguities, it was undisputed that Eldon drafted the document. It is established in that law that ambiguities are construed against the drafters. Secondly, part of the exhibits were the menu that my client, John, had came up with that showed full-service liquor bar on there. There was no question.
So you have a bar and table service.
Right, and we need to talk about brandy and other hard liquors that require something beyond a beer and wine license.
Okay.
So but I believe the district court accepted our representation that it had to be a full license. Our belief it had to be a full license. Mr. Gordana testified in no uncertain terms that he looked at the statute. You cannot have a full liquor license within 1,500 feet of a church or a school. He measured the distance. This was undisputed at the time of trial.
It begs the question because the term license is liquor license is ambiguous.
That's right.
I understand what you're saying, but you seem to have a problem with both sides in terms of representations and due diligence and things of that nature. We have that. Whether that's truly, since it just merely says liquor license, there are lesser licenses which were available. I'm not sure what transpired or did not transpire, but that is really problematic in this, and we come to the point the council raises that prior to the ending of this license period, rent was not paid. What are we to do with that? How should we look at that? How did the district court?
The district court decided that it ended at the time of the end of the liquor license, the temporary liquor license. We stated that as soon as Mr. Gordana found out that he could not get a liquor license, he made affirmative steps at that moment to find another tenant. There was another whole aspect of this trial, which is the failure to allow an assumption of the tenant. That was the testimony by Mr. Duffy.
Was it an automatic assumption or did it was a clear?
Had it been approved by the plaintiff, our allegations from the very inception of this case was that John Gordana, I have to use his full name now, produced a ready, willing, and able, financially able assignee called John Duffy to take over the lease for him, to pay him money to get him out. The judge heard the testimony. She did not believe Mr. Duffy. I have to cut to the chase on that one. But it was undisputed what he was saying, that I have $600,000 in trust. I have $1.3 million in the bank. I don't know what I'm doing. Yes, the judge found that he wasn't a chef. Respectfully, Your Honors, this was the fantasy buyer. He came in, and all he wanted to do was buy it. He wanted to write a check to the plaintiff for 6 months' worth of rent. Said, okay, I'll just write you a check 6 months. We'll take care of this. John Gordana would still be on the hook, but John Duffy was going to take it over. He wanted to do some type of specialty food restaurant where he was not concerned about a full liquor license.
But the appellate court doesn't review the ability of a witness to testify. We don't review credibility.
That's right.
You understand that?
Well, absolutely.
Whatever judge made a decision on credibility, that's the deal here.
Understand, Your Honor. But beyond that, I understand that it's in the sound discretion of the trial of fact, the district court judge. My point would only be on that issue to answer the question for Your Honor is John Duffy did testify that he had these items. Whether the district court believed him or not, the district court found that there was no testimony that he was a chef. My point is that's a collateral issue that has nothing to do. It has nothing to do with credibility. It has nothing to do with him signing for the lease. We got somebody who wants to take it over. John Gordana would still be on the hook.
Okay, well, the bottom line is you won to the extent that it cut off damages from the time you couldn't get the permanent liquor license. So opposing counsel saying your client never even applied because of this 1,500 feet issue.
That's correct.
That. So how long did your client occupy the premises then like that before purportedly terminating the lease?
As the testimony showed from trial, my client was actually involved with Elgin's counsel in getting Mr. Haddad evicted. He was actively involved with that. So it's a difficult question to answer. How long was that?
Here's the problem. The way it works, the way I understand it, and Justice Cherry kind of alluded it to, if it's an issue of the law on it, then it's a de novo review. If it's an issue of fact or a mixed question of fact and law, it's abuse of discretion, not clearly erroneous, it's abuse of discretion. So that is what we're trying. So we have to give deference to the trial judge and what she did. Right or wrong, we have to do that and approach it. And if it's a legal issue, then we can look at it. That's why I brought up the ambiguity of the term liquor license. When it becomes ambiguous, then you can get facts to explain it. I hate to take your time up, but this case is hard for us to kind of get our arms around it and figure out what the heck's going on to properly analyze it because of these collateral civil procedure issues and all that. My concern is this. For the period your client was in there, you owe rent, period, like that. You had the temporary liquor license or whatever. When you left, opposing counsel is saying, well, there was an anticipatory breach of the lease, so therefore you owe the whole thing until the place is was released. The judge didn't agree with that. She said it's only during this temporary liquor license period, if I understand what happened. Okay, tell us why you think the judge did wrong, and I'll have to ask opposing counsel to do likewise.
And before you start, give him 2 more minutes.
I'm sorry.
Two more minutes.
Just trying to get it right.
So we don't have to hear Spoon talking.
Yeah. Regarding possession, just to answer that question real briefly, I believe the record shows that all defendants from both cases, and said the Haddads and my client, were evicted by the end of March 2012.
Okay.
So when I talk about possession, it was not an easy question because there was an eviction, then a temporary liquor license. Back to the calculation of damages set forth by the district court judge. December 21st, 2011 was the date that was found to be in breach of the lease by the court. The court then calculated damages through May 31st, 2012. Rent is as follows. Pursuant to Exhibit 25 from trial, Addendum 1, Exhibit 25 is the lease, Addendum 1 goes to whatever the merits. The rent is $4,000 a month. The cams are $1,400 a month. So that's $5,400 a month. Addendum 1 shows that Belden was tendered a total of $20,000 up front. It designates that as $8,000 security deposit and $8,000 last month rent. I understand that does not mathematically calculate correctly, but that is what Addendum 1 to Exhibit 25 in trial is going to show. The most, then, damages can be calculated at would be the $5,400 per month from December 31st through May 31st, based on what the judge found, less any amount left over from the initial $20,000 deposit, including those extra two $8,000 payments.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize, Your Honors, I do not have that calculation in front of me. I see 52 seconds left.
Well, tell us why you disagree with the opposing counsel's argument that the rent shouldn't be cut off, it should run until the place is relet. Tell us why the judge did not err on that particular point.
Based on the credibility, and again, I'll use that in my favor now, the credibility, the court found that the intent of the parties, the ambiguity was resolved with the condition preceding being a full liquor license. There was a temporary license through May 31st. If the condition preceding is not fulfilled, which is obtaining the full liquor license, not a temporary one, then the contract is not enforceable. It's the get out of jail free card, put it a different way.
Okay, I got it. I understand.
Thank you, Ramos.
Thank you.
Okay, I'd like to wrap up with two things that Mr. Mills brought up. The first one is the Haddad case. What I'd like to address the court with is the Haddad case was not a final judgment under Parkland, and I'll explain why. After it was brought to our attention that the arbitrator had ruled dismissing essentially the case and finding in favor of Anthony Haddad, we filed a motion for an interlocutory, a petition for an interlocutory injunction. There was no opposition, and we got the interlocutory injunction, setting aside the arbitration award, and then proceeding to trial on the merits. It turned out that there was no response of pleading, and we then obtained a default in the case in front of Delaney. So on that lease. That's the first thing that I wanted to clarify to the court, was that essentially there was no final judgment because we set aside the arbitrator's decision through an interlocutory injunction. The second thing that I'd like to address is, again, the liquor license. Okay? There is absolutely no evidence throughout the course of the trial that Mr. Bodana ever applied for a liquor license. There's no evidence that...
I think his argument is he says it would have been futile because of this 1500 fee issue.
I understand, but there's got to, there has to be some type of evidence of due diligence. Okay? There's absolutely none. My position is that essentially you apply for a liquor license, when it gets denied, then you say, I cannot, this lease can't be enforced against me. However, we have no evidence of that. And not only that, when throughout the course of trial, when we presented Bodana with a liquor license, essentially he was surprised. He didn't even know that the police had a liquor license. And so, the law, and I'm going to cite to Broussard v. Hill and NGA number 2, Limited Liability Company versus Reigns, a individual is stopped from asserting an argument seeking relief on a contract when essentially he failed to comply with his obligations under that contract. Essentially, Mr. Bodana cannot say, well, I never got a liquor license, and therefore I'm absolved of the terms of the lease, when, in fact, he never applied for a liquor license. And essentially, he did not put forth any evidence during trial that he made any steps to obtain the liquor license, so it's almost, the court cannot expect us to prove a negative. Because you can't prove a negative. And like I said, the proper steps would have been for Mr. Bodana to try to obtain a liquor license.
Where does the reference temporary liquor license that we see in the order come from then?
I'm sorry?
The term temporary liquor license that ended, where does that come from?
Well, essentially, when a liquor license is issued, and I have that in my brief, and a liquor license is issued on a temporary basis, and then once the conditions are met, and if everything goes smoothly, then you can apply for...
Counsel, let's put it this way. I spent 10 years being the licensing attorney for the county.
Okay.
I kind of know how liquor licenses get done, but that's an aside. That's outside the scope of what's been... But I ask a question in terms of, was there or was there not a temporary liquor license?
Yes. Yes, there was a temporary liquor license issued. And that's where the liquor license came from. And Mr. Haddad had in fact obtained a temporary liquor license.
So you're saying there was one, but then you're saying... your other argument was, since you never made attempt to get this, so I'm saying that these two things are clashing.
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me clarify that for you. Omar Haddad had applied for a liquor license and had gotten a liquor license, okay? John Bordana...
The underlying lease, you have two guarantees, guarantors, you have an LLC who signed the paperwork.
Correct. So we have one of the parties that obtained a temporary liquor license, and then there was a failure to pay rent. The other party never even applied for a liquor license and is claiming that he couldn't get a liquor license. So there was no payment of rent, and then there was an eviction, and neither of them ever tried to pay rent or obtain a liquor license beyond the temporary date.
Thank you. This matter is done. Submitted. We thank counsel for their arguments, trying to create clarity while we're living.